Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terence Azelford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Colleen Delaney. Outlanders number 20, Prodigal Chalice. The bits of jagged metal braided into the leather strands at the whip's end easily cut into the victim's back. Crouched in the shadows of a lightning-blasted cypress tree whose branches were filled with Spanish moss, Kane listened to the woman's shrill screams of pain. Tall and rangy, he resembled a wolf in the way he carried most of his weight in his shoulders. The incessant humidity made his dark hair hang in damp ringlets. His blue-gray eyes took in the details of the scene, while his mind kept the raw emotion at bay. Kane readied the M14 rifle he carried. He wore a loose-fitting, long-sleeved chambray shirt in mottled denim over a Kevlar vest, and his patched jeans were tucked into combat boots. A Colt Government Model 45 rode at his right hip in a paddle holster. The large canvas rucksack at his feet held spare ammunition clips, as well as other weapons. The small boy beside the woman cried out and reached out to hold on to his mother. The boy's efforts to help his mother only hindered her. She tripped over a gnarled root in the inches-deep muck of the swamp that was quickly drying out now that the summer season was upon the land. That was a source of part of the humidity. The other was their relative proximity to the Gulf of Mexico.
Mama!
The little boy tried to wrap his mud-encrusted arms around his mother's leg.
Mama!
The woman was gaunt, and her skin was reddened from the sun. Mud and leaves matted her long brown hair, turning it into a snarling mess. Still, she was young enough and probably attractive enough when she was cleaned up that she would bring a good price in the slave markets near what had been the Grande River, before the nuke cost transformed the world on January 20th, 2001. Kane shifted in the shadows of the cypress, his stomach clenching at the sight of the slave line stumbling through the muck of the dying swamp. Farther east, the swamps were thicker, filled with harsh, flesh-eating acid rain and muty alligators. But the land here held the oppressive heat and dangers of its own. The whip cracked again, targeting the small boy this time. The metal braided into the ends cut deeply into the boy's cheek. Blood ran down the side of his face and dripped onto his scrawny chest. Instinctively, the boy cowered, dropping to his knees in the muck and falling face forward. He wrapped his skinny arms around his head and screamed out in pain. Chained as he was to the 23 other slaves, and given that they were all nearing exhaustion, the boy held up the line. The slaver drew back his whip and cracked it again, opening a new bloody welt across the boy's shoulders. The new onslaught of pain caused the boy to dig more deeply into the muck as he tried to escape. His terror-filled screams reverberated between the tall trees and caused nearby birds to take flight.
No!
The woman stepped protectively in front of her child. Clad as she was in a ragged pair of cloth pants and tattered t-shirt, she was also vulnerable to the whip. Her full round breasts and slim hips showed through the thin material. Clothing wasn't important to the slavers. Once the slaves were on the auction block, the buyers judged them by how healthy they were.
Kane!
Brigid Baptiste crouched less than 10 feet away. Kane kept himself steady as he watched the brutality unfolding. They had come across the slaver's trail by accident only a few hours ago. They already had a mission of their own, but the evidence of footprints of at least 3 small children had set them into this hunt.
Kane, we've got to do something.
We will.
The 9 slavers all had the look of hard men familiar with the life's work they had chosen. They were better fed and in better condition than the 24 slaves they herded. They rode horses and were armed with assault rifles and pistols.
Don't you hit him no more, Luther!
The mother stood in front of her son.
He's just a boy. The strip's hard on him. If you'd stop and give him a little rest, he could make it.
After trailing the slavers the past 20 minutes, Kane was certain Luther was the leader. Raw-boned and twitchy, Luther showed all the signs of a heavy jolt addiction. Down in the swamplands, there were plenty of places to pick up the addictive drug, and it was almost accepted that anyone who had the jack would be a user.
I should have chilled that fucking titsucker when I first laid eyes on him. I've been in this business long enough to know if a kid ain't old enough to walk on his own, he ain't gonna make it.
The slaver leader twitched his whip again, and bright metal shards gleamed in the merciless sun. Sweat beaded his face and neck, and his skin color was flushed with anger and the strong drug moving within his system.
I ain't gonna let you chill my son!
The boy cried out and reached for his mother. A grim grin carved Luther's narrow face.
I don't see how you can stop me, bitch.
You'll have to kill me too, and I know you don't want to do that.
Brigid shifted in the brush nearby, and Kane hoped that none of the slavers would hear her. She wasn't used to this kind of work, but Kane knew she was getting better at it. Brigid had been an archivist in Cobaltville less than 2 years ago, before being recruited by Mohandas Lakesh Singh to join the group of rebels in Cerberus Redoubt. In their war against the baronies, they were fighting the tyranny and deceit of the barons and their mysterious backers. Now a fugitive, Brigid knew how to kill, but she still lacked finesse when it came to timing an ambush. Kane glanced to the other side of the trail. Even with his keen eyesight and knowing that Grant was there, Kane couldn't see his partner of many years. But he trusted Grant implicitly. When the chips were down, Grant would be at his side. This day would be no different. Lifting the M14 combat rifle he had chosen from the Cerberus armory, Kane centered the open sights on Luther's neck. His finger settled easily over the trigger and took up the slight slack. He snugged the rifle butt up against his shoulder and settled into his crouching position.
Woman, you got what we call an overinflated sense of yourself.
He raised the battered Colt CAR-15 carbine and pointed it at her.
You see, I'm in charge of this here expedition. Anybody who gets in my way gets fucking chilled. And that's an ace on the line. Hell, I'll load you and that damn titsucker up on the last train headed west myself.
The woman stood uncertainly for a moment, gazing around at the other 22 slaves. All of the other slaves dropped their heads and looked away from her. Kane didn't hold their decision against them. Chained and unarmed, they stood no chance at all against the slavers. It would be mass suicide to side with the woman and her child. To their way of thinking, it was better to be sold as a slave than to die where they stood. At least there was some chance of escape from the Tartarus pits.
Step away from the titsucker!
Luther peered over his rifle.
No!
The woman pulled a rock from the muck and threw it at Luther. The rock hit Luther's horse in the muzzle. Startled, the animal reacted by bucking.
Luther cursed
and grabbed for the saddle horn in an effort to keep from being thrown. The effort failed, and Luther flew from his mount, crashing to the ground nearby. Kane followed the man with the M14 sights.
Stupid bitch!
Luther got to his feet unsteadily. His anger made him shake all over. He pulled the assault rifle to his shoulder.
Now you're gonna get chilled, bitch. Keep standing there in front of your brat like that, and it won't take but the one bullet between you.
Kane saw the man's finger whitening on the trigger.
Kane!
This time, the slavers heard her. Cursing, Kane followed his target's swinging head, knowing the other slavers were already targeting their positions. He squeezed the trigger and rode out the M14's recoil, moving on to his next target because he knew with grim certainty that Luther would no longer be in the game. The M14 steel-jacketed 7.62mm slug cored through his target's throat, smacking into the spinal cord and shoving it in glistening shards through the back of the man's neck. Luther collapsed like a puppet with its strings cut as Kane centered the rifle sights on the middle of another slaver's broad chest. Kane snapped off the round too quickly because the man was already in motion. Knowing he had missed his target, Kane threw himself to the left toward Bridget's position because he didn't think she knew the danger they were in. A swath of bullets hammered the area behind the cypress tree where Kane had been hiding. Just as Kane had thought, Bridget stood behind a tree but was coolly taking aim with the copperhead she was carrying. The close assault weapon was gas-operated and had the potential to cycle 700 rounds per minute through the barrel. However, the magazines of 4.85mm ammunition held only 15 rounds. In the hands of an amateur, someone not trained to fire in three-round bursts, the assault rifle would be emptied and nothing flat. Brigid Baptiste, beautiful and now deadly, had learned how to fire three-round bursts. She put two tri-bursts into the slaver nearest her, punching her target off the horse. From the corner of his eye, Kane noticed for the first time that not all of the slavers were men. As the slaver that Brigid had shot tumbled to the ground, pale blonde hair shook free from under her floppy hat and neckerchief. The woman slaver flailed out weakly, tried to push up twice, then collapsed to the ground. By that time, another of the slavers ripped a grin from the bandolier across his chest and threw the explosive toward the tree Bridget took cover behind. Bridget was so intent on protecting the slaves that she didn't notice the lobbed grin. Cain scooped her up in one long arm as he rushed by her. His momentum pulled her along with him, and he drove his feet hard against the ground, trying to put as much distance between himself and the explosive as he could. Bullets ripped through the leafy canopy above their heads. Then an unseen cypress root caught Cain's foot and sent them both sprawling.
Oh!
Recovering quickly, Cain shouldered the M14 as one of the slavers rode toward him, an Uzi subgun in his right hand. The Uzi stuttered and jerked in the slaver's grip, and 9mm rounds sliced through the air. Cain registered the heat of a bullet passing his face even as he squeezed the rifle's trigger. It had been that close. The heavy 7.62mm round caught the approaching slaver in the upper chest and knocked him off the back of the horse. Freed from the rider, the big animal got its head and ran to Cain's right. Bridget pushed up to her feet.
Why did you do that?
Before Cain could explain, the grin was off. The explosion ripped through the swampy forest with deafening intensity. All sound evaporated for just a moment, and Cain's head filled with staticky white noise. The explosive had been an anti-personnel charge. The pellets spread in a killing radius of 30 feet, tearing through brush instantly. The horse was broadside to the blast, and the pellets tore through its ribcage, ripping its lungs to shreds. Knocked from its feet, already dying, the horse fell within arm's reach of Cain. Blood sprayed from the animal's nostrils as it breathed its last. Cain's hearing returned in a rush. He heard the distinctive roar of Domi's .357 Magnum revolver, backed up by Grant's Copperhead.
I didn't know.
Bridget gazed down at the dead horse. Her reddish-gold hair was pulled back in a ponytail and hung at shoulder level. Although slender, she was full-breasted and stood nearly as tall as Cain. Her olive-drab t-shirt was tucked into military-style camouflage pants. Her emerald-green eyes peered at him anxiously from her beautiful face.
Are you all right?
No foul, Baptiste.
Cain turned his attention to rescuing the rest of the slaves. The surviving slavers had fled to the forest, taking advantage of the cover there. The slaves, however, had not been so fortunate. Linked by collars and chains, unified by a single thought but not a single mind, the slaves had tried to rush in all directions at once. They only succeeded in becoming a confused jumble in the center of the clearing. Seeking to vent their anger and fear on something or someone, the slavers opened fire on the slaves. Their bullets chopped down a man and a teenage girl. With those bodies attached by the chains, the slaves had even less chance than before.
Grant, go! I'm going to flush them out.
Do it. I got you six.
Cain surveyed the tree line the slavers had chosen for cover. Moving forward, he quickly searched the corpse of the man he'd shot from the horse's back. The dead man's bandolier held two more grenades. Cain took them both, guessing that they were probably anti-personnel as well. He glanced up and saw Bridget looking at him.
Stay here. If you get the chance, see if you can free those slaves. They're too exposed where they are.
Cain scanned the tree line again and noted the shadow shifting among the trees. Evidently, the slavers were certain how many people they were up against and thought perhaps they might still be able to salvage some of their human cargo. And if they couldn't, Cain knew there was every chance that they would try to kill the slaves as payback for the people they had lost. Cain moved expertly through the brush, keeping his eyes and ears open. The earlier explosion still caused ringing in his hearing, but it wasn't anything he couldn't compensate for by watching. Cain kept moving swiftly, taking advantage of the cover offered by the trees along the way. A line of bullets tore through the branches over his head. He hunkered down behind the nearest tree and then felt it vibrate as more bullets slammed into the trunk.
Grant!
Cain then heard the sudden roar of Grant's Copperhead burning through an entire magazine at once. It wasn't something Grant did without extreme provocation. Magistrates were chosen and bred for their military abilities, and then they were drilled until the day they died.
Can't help. Bridget's making her bid at a one percenter.
A one percenter was a common term among magistrates. It generally referred to the chances a magistrate had of surviving a chosen course of action. Cain craned his head around the tree and peered toward the area where he'd left the former archivist. Her reddish-gold hair flashed in the sun as she raced across the clearing to the slaves. Bullets from the concealed slavers smacked into the thick mud around her. The mother who had tried to protect her son now crouched over him protectively, her arms wrapped tightly around him. On one side of her, a dead man lay face down in the mud. Chained to the dead man, she had no hope of getting her son or herself to safety. The little boy screamed and kicked his feet against the mud, crying out so loudly now that his voice broke. It was a trap, Cain knew. The surviving slavers had deliberately left the woman and her child in the open as bait. They probably thought Bridget was family, hell-bent on rescuing them. Without warning, one of the slavers spurred his horse into the clearing. He was young and lean and lay down over the top of his mount like another layer of hair. He rode straight for Bridget, a long-barreled pistol coming up in one hand.
Bridget!
Kane knew the warning was too little, too late. He started to get up, then a bullet smashed into his sternum. Even as everything started to go black, Kane saw more men approaching at a quick trot. The slavers had been closer to reinforcements than Kane had expected. Mohandas Lakesh Singh stared at the huge Mercator map on one wall in the command center of the Cerberus Redoubt, which was located in the Bitterroot mountain range in Montana. A headache throbbed at his temples, and he finally turned away from the map. If there were any answers there to the problems that he faced now, he didn't see them, nor had he seen them in days. Lakesh glanced at the Mattrans unit at the other end of the room. The brown armaglass walls gleamed dully. His research had been partially responsible for the final design of the Mattrans units. They had been secretly built and scattered around the world, hidden away in redoubts just like the one here at Cerberus, allowing for instantaneous transportation of people and materials. But the gifts of the Archons hadn't come without price. The Archons brought about the world war that had destroyed all the superpowers and plunged human civilization back into the Dark Ages. That human civilization, however, had proved incredibly resourceful. For the past two centuries, the survivors of Skydark had been crawling back up to the top of the food chain. Immediately after the nuke cost, Lakesh had volunteered to be cryogenically frozen and placed in the Anthill, the Totality Concept's largest hidden facility. He was supposed to be part of the subsequent Program of Unification, an effort designed solely to take over what was left of the world. Once he had been revived, Lakesh saw the errors in his judgment. As senior archivist in Cobaltville, he had spent years plotting against the ruthless designs of the Archons. It had taken almost 50 years to find a group of people with enough strength, cunning, and resources to stand against the Baronial Alliance. And the group he had gone to such pains to select often did not agree with the goals he set or the means with which he chose to pursue them. Lakesh glanced at the Mercator map again. The world was so big, and yet there had to be some way to set everything aright that he had unwittingly helped go so horribly wrong. That guilt colored everything he did, and his confidence that he would find a way kept him going on day after day. This day was one of the days Lakesh felt trapped. The need to be out and doing something was incredible. He paced the room and tried to work off some of the excess nervous energy.
You're going to give yourself a coronary if you keep that pacing up.
Lakesh recognized the amused female voice immediately and turned to face the woman.
Good afternoon, my dear Dr. DeFore. Welcome to my sanctum sanctorum.
DeFore smiled warily.
Said the spider to the fly.
She wore the one-piece white uniform common throughout the redoubt. She was deeply bronzed by natural coloration, and it contrasted sharply with her braided ash-blonde hair. She was buxom and stocky. Lakesh frowned at the woman. Their relationship was awkward at best. Like Kane and the others, DeFore did not take well to his organized leadership and centralized control.
I must assure you, Dr. DeFore, sarcasm does not well suit you.
Let's split the difference and call it a genetic deficiency, because I find my sarcasm very entertaining. The only thing I find lacking is a good audience.
DeFore glanced at him and smiled.
However, I usually find a dearth of ammunition.
As you can see, I am quite busy. If there is anything you need...
There's some scuttlebutt going around the redoubt about the latest mission you sent Kane and the others on.
Lakesh stiffened in displeasure.
I see. And you're down here to assuage curiosity on behalf of the other people here?
No. I'm here acting in a professional capacity.
DeFore crossed her arms over her breasts and glanced at the Mattrans unit.
When I found out Kane and the others had jumped out of here through that thing, I figured I'd come down here and see what kind of damage to expect when they jump back through.
She looked at Lakesh.
They are jumping back, aren't they?
My dear doctor, I appreciate your enthusiasm for your professional responsibilities, but I assure you this is nothing more than a... What do Kane and Grant call these sorties?
A soft probe recon.
Donald Bry spoke from his workstation. He was the leading tech at the redoubt and usually oversaw all of the group's away missions. He was a small man in a white lab coat with rounded shoulders and copper-colored hair.
"Do you see, my dear doctor? Even the name is innocuous."
DeFore changed her attention to Bry.
"Where are they?"
"Almost as close to what used to be Houston as they can get, without stepping off into the Gulf of Mexico."
Bry watched the comp screen in front of him.
"And they're well?"
"Dr. DeFore, if Kane and the others weren't all right, surely you would realize they would already have been down to visit you in the med bay."
Lakesh never liked being questioned, especially about things that he intended to keep private. Despite the fact Cerberus personnel all ultimately worked toward the same goals, those goals being, for the most part, the goals that Lakesh designed, not all of them needed daily updates.
"I figured that depended a lot on how many pieces of themselves they had to find first."
"I'm afraid, Dr. DeFore, that I no longer find your sarcasm inviting in any manner whatsoever."
"I just want to know more about what's going on."
"You'll know when you need to know, my dear doctor."
"All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Is that what you're implying?"
DeFore gazed steadily at Lakesh with arched brows. A brief spate of quiet and contained laughter came from Bry at his workstation, but he quickly covered it by feigning a cough. Lakesh shook his head. He really didn't want to deal with this now. Ever since Kane had arrived at the redoubt, his rebellious ways had seemed to spread. Everything would work so much more easily if all those involved would simply recognize the fact that someone needed to be in control.
"The quote is from a book called Animal Farm. It was written by a man named George Orwell, and he had a view of society that I find very appropriate to your way of conducting operations here at Cerberus Redoubt."
Lakesh said nothing.
"If you're not familiar with the book, I'll lend you a copy. In fact, you may find that it's getting very popular around here."
"Dr. DeFore, really, I would expect you to find better uses for your time."
"Than reading?"
DeFore shook her head.
"No, I don't think I can give that up. I find it entirely too enlightening."
Deciding that discretion was the better part of valor, Lakesh capitulated. He gazed up meaningfully at the huge Mercator map.
"As you're aware, this map shows the locations of all known Matrans chambers throughout the world."
"If you're so sure that all of the gateways are shown on this map, then why did you send Kane and the others down to the Gulf of Mexico to investigate a Matrans unit?"
"If you had all the answers, then why did you come here with questions?"
"You can't believe every rumor that goes through this place."
"Obviously, if people have so much time on their hands for idle chatter, I don't have enough for them to do. Perhaps you would like to help me correct that oversight."
"What is so important about this Matrans unit? I know that Kane would not have wasted his time or risked his ass on this mission if you hadn't made a believer out of him."
"Actually, friend Kane made a believer out of me this time. A few weeks ago, friend Bry noticed that an until now malfunctioning Matrans unit suddenly went online. It's not located in any of the 9 baronies."
"Then what are Kane and the others doing down around the Gulf? That's in Samariumville and definitely one of the baronies."
"Jumping straight to the now-functioning Matrans unit that we want to investigate didn't seem like such a good idea to Kane and Grant."
Bry spoke up unexpectedly, still with a little humor in his voice.
"They especially didn't like the idea after the probe we sent through was destroyed. Kind of put a damper on the whole picnic."
"Instead, Kane and Grant, along with Bridget and darlingest Domi, chose to pursue their investigation in another manner, one that they hoped would be less risky."
He walked over to the Mercator map and pointed to a redoubt located west of what had been the Texas-Louisiana state line.
"The redoubt here was located on the Grande River. It's little used by any of the baronies because it's located in harsh territory filled with deadly dangers."
"And this is the safest route?"
"This is the route that Kane and Grant elected to travel from."
Actually, DeFore's comments reawakened Lakesh's own misgivings about the course of action. The redoubt by the Grande River was not safe by any means. Of late, the area around Redoubt Delta had become a hotbed of slavery. Seeking to replenish slaves in the Tartarus pits at Cobaltville, Baron Cobalt had underwritten a massive slave-procuring operation west of the Redoubt Delta area and close to the coastline. To meet the increased supply issues, Vils had sprung up in the area. The Grande River Redoubt wasn't used for the slave transportation routes, and in fact was seldom used at all. Crews were outfitted and sent north through what had been Oklahoma and on into Colorado. The Redoubt Delta's slavery operation wasn't the only one going on. Several others had been established in the Western Isles and along the Atlantic coastline in Sharpeville. Slavery operations based in the northern reaches of Cobaltville, Mandeville, and Snakefishville staged raids into Ragnarville on a semi-regular basis, taking advantage of the fact that Baron Ragnar had been killed by Tara, and the barony was leaderless and in a state of flux.
Baron Cobalt only runs magistrates and equipment through the Grande River Redoubt 2 or 3 times a month. It's not used often, and I do have access when it's in use. It was simple to arrange a jump to the Grande River Redoubt without Baron Cobalt's knowledge.
So where is this mysterious MAT-TRANS unit?
It's on the northeastern side of the Yucatan Peninsula, in the Gulf of Mexico area. Friend Kane and Friend Grant intend to liberate a sail craft along the coastline and sail it to the Yucatan Peninsula to investigate.
How much do we know about those areas down there?
Historically, the Yucatan Peninsula is a fascinating place.
Lakesh smiled, warming to the subject.
It was the land of the Maya. Most scholars believe the Maya originated sometime between 2600 and 1000 BC. Most believe that the original people who came to be called the Maya migrated from North America. That is, of course, after they originally migrated from Asia across the Bering Strait, when a land bridge connected Alaska and Siberia. In the beginning, what scholars called the pre-classic period, the Maya people were not organized. However, sometime during that age, they started to band together, and when they did, they recognized chiefs and kings. The idea of royalty followed after that. Their society quickly became very similar to the European nations. They had warriors, nobles, architects, administrators, merchants and farmers, as well as other classes. Later, during the Classic period, the Maya people made a number of advances in construction, cosmology, art, and science.
Defoe looked at Lakesh.
Weren't the Maya people the ones who believed in Quetzalcoatl?
No, that was the Toltecs and Aztecs. He was also called the feathered or plumed serpent god. The Aztecs believed Cortez was Quetzalcoatl, returning to fulfill an ancient prophecy.
But it was only the arrival of the Spaniards.
Exactly. The Maya called him Kukulcan, and he was also known as the feathered or plumed serpent. The Toltec of Tula, which was an ancient city in a country called Hidalgo before the Nucost, moved south into Campeche, the same area that Grant and Kane are headed into. Kukulcan became their leader in occupied Chichen Itza. Chichen Itza is centrally located in the Yucatan Peninsula and was built around 2 large cenotes.
I'm not familiar with that term.
Cenotes are natural wells. Chichen Itza is believed to have been an astronomical observatory.
Didn't the Maya also believe in human sacrifice?
Yes.
Defoe studied the Mercator map some more.
I don't suppose there's any chance that Kane and the others will run into any Maya?
My dear doctor, there's very little chance of that. Campeche was, until Skydark, a tourist area and a source of oil. As I recall, considerable interest was directed to that area because of the offshore oil rigs out in the Gulf. The people who depended on the tourist trade hated the oil refineries that sprang up in the area. The Gulf is also home to a lot of hurricane activity, and there were several accidents involving offshore rigs that affected the wildlife in the area, as well as the tourist trade.
Marquez shook his head.
The people in that area had probably lost most of their cultural attachments long before the Nucost. After 200 years of barbarism since that time, I think the last thing our friends have to worry about is becoming a human sacrifice to Mayan gods.
Then what's your interest in the MAT-TRANS unit in Campeche?
A non-functioning MAT-TRANS unit simply does not go back online after more than 200 years.
Are you sure that it hasn't been functional in the past 200 years?
Lakesh hesitated. He hated being uncertain, and he hated even more being uncertain in front of others.
No, I can't say that.
Then why worry about one Mattrans unit going online?
Lakesh shrugged.
I don't think either friend Kane or myself is especially worried about this Mattrans unit, but it could be a good thing to know.
Do the Barons know about this?
Not that I'm aware of, my dear doctor.
Lakesh knew DeFore was referring to the eavesdropping system Bry had established through the communications link-up with the ComSat satellite Cerberus had access to. It was the same system and same satellite they used to track information from the subcutaneous transponders implanted within Cerberus personnel, which relayed location as well as heart rate, respiration, blood count, and brainwave patterns. Bry had been working on a system for a long time and had recently developed an undetected method of patching into the wireless communication channels all of the baronies had in one form or another. The success rate wasn't 100%, but they had been able to eavesdrop on some of the vills and some of the baron-sanctioned operations in the outlands. They monitored different frequencies on a daily basis. Lately, all the talk among the different baronies had been skewed toward rebuilding much of what they had lost.
Lakesh!
Turning toward Bry, noting instantly the agitation in the little man's voice, Lakesh scanned the comp screen at the workstation.
What is it, friend Bry?
It's Kane.
His stubby fingers rattled the keyboard in front of him.
His heart just stopped.
Bridget Baptiste ran for her life, but she also ran for the lives of the mother hunched protectively over her child in the center of the clearing. Pumping her arms, sprinting for all she was worth, Bridget heard the detonations of rounds cycling through different weapons, amazed at how she could identify nearly all of them. She had been born with an eidetic memory that had proved itself basically photographic over the years, so remembering something when she had seen it or heard it wasn't astounding. What was astounding was how much she had been exposed to over the past 2 years. As an archivist, she had led a very sheltered life in some respects. She knew about the black-clad magistrates who patrolled Cobaltville, but she'd had little interaction with them. And she'd had even less interactions with the slaves who toiled in the Tartarus pits. Since joining up with Kane and Grant and accompanying them on some of their missions away from Cerberus Redoubt, she had learned a lot about cruelty and death. She had learned a lot as an archivist, reading all the files for Baron Cobalt. However, that training was nothing like the face-to-face confrontations that Kane and Grant lived. While hiding in the brush, waiting for the proper moment to ambush the slavers, Bridget had felt guilty when the mother stood up for her child. Bridget had known Kane and Grant were delaying for a reason, but waiting had proved hard when she thought it was going to cost the life of the mother. And maybe Kane would have waited. That was one of the major differences between them. There was no doubt in Bridget that Kane would save the slaves if at all possible, but she also knew his magistrate training would allow for sacrifices to be made, if necessary, for the greater good. Now, closing in on the mother and her child and listening to the drum of gunfire all around her, Bridget knew she had made more than one mistake in the past 2 minutes. The woman and her child had been left deliberately. Bridget's breath burned the back of her throat as she ran. Pulling up short, feeling the thick mud skid from under her boots, she looked at the fearful mother holding her child. Quickly, Bridget aimed her copperhead at the chain linking the woman and her child to the dead man beside her. The copperhead danced in Bridget's hands as she squeezed the trigger and held it down. The bullet sparked against the chain, making it jump, but shattered the links. Bridget grabbed the woman by the shoulder and pulled her to her feet.
Go! Get out of here! Get your son out of here!
Bridget!
Recognizing Kane's voice, Bridget looked up just in time to see a horseman bearing down on her. The slaver hauled up his right arm and pointed a revolver at Bridget. A snarling smile covered his face, partially obscured by the horse's flying mane. He was young, but he had a mouthful of splintered and missing teeth. Huge clods spewed out behind the horse as its hooves raked mud from the drying swamp. Automatically, with an alacrity that both disturbed her and made her proud, Bridget pulled the copperhead to her shoulder. She didn't bother to sight the weapon, but relied on instinct and past experience. Her finger slid over the trigger, and she squeezed, just as Grant and Kane had taught her. The copperhead remained mute. The assault rifle was empty, she realized. She had blasted through the whole magazine, cutting through the slave chains. Death came for Bridget Baptiste on drumming horses' hooves. She watched the slaver's right hand bounce as his arm took on the heavy pistol's recoil. The heavy caliber bullet cut through the air and ripped out the outside thigh of Bridget's camouflage pants. For a moment, she thought she'd been hit, and then she realized she was still standing. The slaver came on, only a few feet away from her now. His thumb raked forward and pulled the hammer back to fire again. The pistol was a single-action revolver, and maybe that saved her life. Moving quickly, Bridget reversed the copperhead and held it by the heated muzzle. Luckily, she hadn't fired enough rounds to seriously overheat the barrel and didn't suffer any burning. Bridget stepped to the side, pulled the assault rifle back like a baseball player she'd seen in an old vid in the Cobaltville archives, and swung with everything she had. The copperhead's abbreviated stock slammed against the slaver's gun wrist. Bridget distinctly heard bone splinter a split second before the sharp report of the pistol. The slaver lost his grip on the pistol, and it spun through the air, catching the sun. Bridget lost the copperhead as well, surprised at how much impact there had been with the contact. The horse stumbled on the dead man lying at Bridget's feet and fell into her, catching her in the chest with its muscled shoulder. Knocked from her feet, Bridget sailed through the air and splatted onto the swamp mud with bruising force. Her lungs searched desperately for air, and her vision swam with black spots. She willed herself to move, remembering the trajectory of the falling pistol and where it had to be.
"Come here, bitch!"
Incredibly, the young slaver rose from the swamp bed.
"I ain't done with you yet!"
Mud clung to him in great clods and fell from him as he whipped a long-bladed hunting knife from his belt at his back. A necklace of shriveled flesh bounced against his stained shirt. He grinned at her, exposing diseased gums and stubs of broken black teeth.
"I'm gonna take your ears back with me, and that's a fact."
Bridget made no reply. She dived for the pistol, lying only a few feet away. On the other side of the clearing, Grant leaped from cover and ran toward the slaves, screaming something that Bridget found unintelligible at the moment. The pistol lay half buried in the mud. Bridget recognized it easily as a Colt single-action army knockoff of the Peacemaker. The revolver had first been introduced to the American Army in 1873, and the cartridge pistol had changed the world. Until that time, the United States Cavalry had been using black powder pistols, which made reloading much slower. The Model P-1940 lying in the mud was chambered in .4440 Magnum rounds and held 6 shots. As she grabbed the pistol's butt, Bridget remembered that at least 2 rounds had been fired, maybe more. The pistol felt incredibly heavy in Bridget's hand as she dragged it from the swamp bed. Thick mud dropped from the weapon as she raised it and spun to meet her attacker. The slaver held his heavy-bladed knife in his left hand but looked to be entirely comfortable with it.
"Gonna die!"
He charged toward her. Coolly, ignoring the fierce throbbing fear knotting her stomach, Bridget thumbed back the big pistol's hammer and slid her finger inside the mud-caked trigger guard. With the hammer back, the necessary trigger pull was no more than a twitch. The hammer fell as Bridget remembered the pistol had been in the mud, and she didn't know if the barrel was clear. There was every chance that the shell would detonate and explode in her hand. The slaver was less than 2 feet out from Bridget when the .44 fired. For a moment, Bridget thought the pistol had exploded in her hand. She fully expected to see only twisted flesh and broken bone at the end of her wrist when she next looked at it. Instead, the big .44 roared and a foot-long muzzle flash leaped from the barrel and touched the slaver's face. At the same instant, the heavy round smashed into the slaver's gaping mouth, breaking through rotted teeth and punching through his palate. Gray and crimson matter erupted from the huge hole in the back of his skull. Without another sound, the slaver jerked to a sudden stop, his corpse slammed back by the impact. He fell backward. Bridget glanced at her hand and saw that she still somehow held on to the Colt.
"Bridget!"
This time she recognized the voice belonged to Grant. She moved toward the tree line where Kane had headed. Recovering, Bridget scanned the surrounding ground and spotted her copperhead lying half buried under the wounded horse. She kept hold of the .44 with her numbed hand, but made her way over to the assault rifle. After slipping the heavy Colt between her belt and the waistband of her pants, Bridget reloaded the copperhead with a fresh magazine and readied the weapon. Painful pinpricks signaled the return of feeling to her numbed hand. She turned and scanned the tree line. At least 4 of the slavers were dead from her efforts and Kane's. That left at most 5 more. The line of slaves ran toward the opposite side of the clearing. They worked together to pull on the chain, dragging 3 corpses and at least 1 wounded person after them. Sprinting, Bridget ran to the tree line to her left. She fell into position behind a thick, bold tree and prepared to give Grant covering fire. Standing 4 inches over 6 feet, Grant was a veritable mountain of a man. He was thick and broad-shouldered, his bare arms showing corded muscle. But there were scars on his coffee-brown skin that spoke of past encounters with bullets, knives, and searing fire. Gray dusted his short-cropped curly hair. A gunfighter mustache framed his mouth and chin. He wore jeans and a green sweatshirt with the sleeves hacked off. A canvas rucksack, the second of the war bags that Kane and Grant had filled from Cerberus' stores before they'd made the Mattrans jump, hung over one broad shoulder. Besides the copperhead in his hands, he carried a Colt Government Model 45 that was a twin of the one Kane carried as a backup weapon. The muzzle of a .30-30 slid around the tree in front of Grant and took aim. Without hesitation, Bridget opened up and placed 2 3-round bursts into the tree, then 6 inches behind the tree. The bullets slapping into the tree served as a warning to the shooter and splintered the bark, so there would be no confusion as to how close Bridget had come. The 3 rounds behind the tree were hopeful. A moment later, a man stumbled from hiding with both hands wrapped around his bleeding throat. He fell to his knees in the clearing, crimson threading through his fingers. He fell into the mud and twitched spasmodically. That was 6. Confirmed. Domi broke cover to Grant's right with the lithe stride of an attacking cougar. Her appearance was striking. At first glance, she looked like a child. Domi stood only a couple of inches over 5 feet in height. She kept her bone-white hair cropped short, and her fine, delicate features made her look like a porcelain doll, especially since she was a true albino and had paper-white skin. She wore winter camouflage pants patterned in white, gray, and black splotches, and a tight-fitting, deep-purple tank top under a baggy black lightweight jacket. Her camo pants were tucked tightly into the tops of her combat boots. Halfway to the tree line, Domi raised her .357 Magnum revolver in both hands and ripped off 3 rapid-fire shots. The 3 reports rolled like thunder through the trees. In the next instant, Domi disappeared into the forest with hardly a leaf stirring in her wake. Bridget risked a glance at the freed slaves hiding in the brush on the other side of the clearing, not far from her position. She caught a quick glimpse of the mother and son huddling behind a fallen tree. Spotting Grant pulling up short beside a tree, Bridget watched as a sudden spray of bark and white splinters exploded toward the clearing.
Reinforcements!
Grant shoved a fresh clip into his copperhead.
How many?
Bridget was already on the move, gathering up the war bag she and Kane had left behind earlier and circling within the tree line to reach a position near Grant's.
Can't tell.
Grant readied his weapon.
Enough to take all the fun out of this. And while we have the chance, let me tell you, that play you just did has got to be the riskiest thing I've seen intentionally done in a long time.
Bridget didn't know whether to feel insulted or appreciated. With Kane and Grant, sometimes it was hard to tell. As she rounded the next clump of brush, she spotted the new arrivals. They were on foot and moved through the forest as if they'd been born there. Given the circumstances, Bridget believed they probably had been. Still, they didn't seem to be as well-armed as the initial group of slavers. Bridget counted 11 men as she lifted the copperhead. She aimed at the unsuspecting man in her sights and fired without a second thought. The slavers in the area were killers. That had been confirmed by reports Bri had overheard in communications from Cobaltville. The 3-round burst snapped the man's head back, and blood misted over the leaves and branches behind him.
I count 10!
Bridget whirled back around the tree. Several rounds cored into the tree and through the brush around her. Even as the shooting slowed and the man checked to see if he had hit her, she stepped away from the tree to the left and remained within the brush, dropping into a duck walk to stay below cover.
10! Was 11, but not no more!
Suddenly, Bridget realized she hadn't heard anything from Kane since he'd first called out the warning to her. A small, quiet fear dawned within her. She tried, but couldn't shake it off. The clearing and the surrounding forest was filled with the stench of cordite and refined gunpowder. Her right hand still tingled from the .44's recoil, but the feeling was coming back.
Grant!
Yeah?
Where's Kane?
When the answer wasn't immediately forthcoming, the fear grew inside Bridget. Kane and Grant had watched each other's backs for so long that it seemed one could hardly be anywhere that the other did not know. Part of it was the magistrate training they had undergone in Cobaltville, but they had also developed special combat senses over the years of their partnership.
Don't know. Lost him when he went into the brush.
Bridget pushed her breath out. She remembered seeing Kane step into the forest near the position she held now. And if he had to have run into the men now moving through the forest around them. Or had they run into him? Heart beating a little faster, Bridget peered through the forest. The thick canopy overhead muted sunlight that came down harsh and glaring into the clearing. Light in the forest took on a hazy green ambience and angled through the branches in small columns no thicker than her wrist. A pistol barrel moved through the brush to Bridget's left. Reacting immediately, Bridget lifted the copperhead and pointed into the brush. She squeezed off 3-round bursts that emptied the assault rifle's magazine. Even as the body fell backward on the other side of the brush, she fished out another magazine and slapped it into the copperhead.
9!
8!
Bridget knew the albino had resorted to her knives. In the brush, they were just as effective as her pistol and didn't give away her position as easily. But Bridget's mind kept drifting back to Kane and wondering where he was. Prowling through the forest like this, fighting for his life, those were the things that he excelled in. Nothing, she told herself, could have happened to him. But as his location remained a mystery, she found she had to work to believe it. A man's voice roared out of the wilderness.
Hey, let's dicker a little bit about this situation.
Ain't nothing to talk about. If you don't want to get killed, pick your asses up and leave the forest.
Now let's look at this a little bit. Last thing you want to be doing is going off half-cocked. The way I look at it, there's enough slaves here for us all. The barons, they're all paying a fair amount of jack these days. And there's plenty of slaves if a man knows where to look and is willing to risk a little.
Bridget moved forward cautiously, her thoughts sliding through her mind as she worried about Kane's disappearance and getting out of the present confrontation alive. She knelt down over the man she had just killed. Keeping an eye peeled, she ran a hand over the man's body, checking for weapons that she might use. The only thing he had was the .22 Colt Woodsman that he had aimed at her.
We got more people than you people have.
Remembering some of the information she had read about weapons while at Cerberus, Bridget took the .22 Colt Woodsman. Checking it, she found there were still 7 .22 long rifle rounds in the magazine. She drew a small knife from her boot and quickly cut the man's shirt off him. Working quickly, she wrapped the shirt into a ball and placed it over the end of the target pistol. She took the roll of ordnance tape from the war bag and looped it around the wadded shirt, securing it to the Colt Woodsman's barrel. She stood, slinging the copperhead over her shoulder, and went forward with the .22 clasped in both hands. Domi leaned quietly towards Bridget.
7. Maybe not so many now, huh?
A sudden burst of gunfire ripped the quiet that had descended on the forest surrounding the clearing.
Your guy missed. Doesn't say a lot for believability, does it? Or accuracy, either.
A twig snapped in front of Bridget less than 10 feet away. Holding the .22 Colt Woodsman in both hands, Bridget moved as gracefully as a dancer and stepped into the sheltering cover of the brush circling a cypress tree. The Spanish moss hung thickly over her head. The sweet, rotting smell of bougainvillea filled her nose as the brush closed over the front of her.
Wasn't my guy. It was one of that original bunch you people braced.
You were out here sniping, is that it? How am I supposed to trust someone lying in ambush and trying to get the same thing I was after?
You ambush them first. You got no call to be saying you can't trust me.
Two men stepped in front of Bridget. They both held lever-action rifles at the ready and faced away from her as they surveyed the forest carefully. Calmly, Bridget pushed her arms out and held the .22 Colt Woodsman level. She let out half her breath and held it. Wrapped in the shirt as it was, she knew the pistol's noise was going to be negligible. Hopefully, it would be enough to give her the advantage of time she needed to take care of the second man. The drawback was that the .22 long rifle rounds had almost no knockdown power. Bridget strode from the tree silently, pressed the shirt-wrapped pistol barrel against the back of the first man's head, and squeezed the trigger 3 times in rapid succession. The .22 cycled through all 3 rounds with no problem. Hollow pops echoed in the immediate vicinity as the man's head jerked with each impact. Still, the noise was enough to draw the attention of his companion. The man turned quickly, bringing up his lever-action rifle. Bridget closed on the dead man before he could fall. She grabbed the back of the shirt collar with her left hand, slammed her body against his to help with the support, and thrust the .22 Colt Woodsman over the dead man's shoulder. Holding the corpse up and using him as a flesh-and-blood shield, Bridget aimed at the other man's head. Only a headshot would take him out, because the .22 rounds would just flatten out against the man's sternum. The shirt wrapped around the Colt Woodsman smoked, and embers actually caught fire as Bridget fired again. She felt the corpse shiver against her as the other man's rifle round hit him. All 4 of the .22 rounds smacked into her adversary's face. At least one of them got him in the right eye, and another penetrated the thin bone above the bridge of his nose. His body jerked for a moment, then lay still. Bridget tossed away the empty weapon and slid the copperhead from her shoulder. She quickly verified that both men were dead. The .22 rounds had a habit of bouncing around inside a person's skull once they got there, never getting out again, and cutting the brain to pieces while they were in motion.
5.
Bridget was still on the move.
Didn't lose count. I took down 2 of them that time.
Hey, did you get that? Maybe we should take a minute and discuss whether or not I'm willing to let you out of here with your ass intact.
The silence drifted through the forest. Domi scanned the woods.
4. Guess I got one doing all talking.
How about it? Anybody else feel like being the leader?
Bridget froze as she heard the sudden movement in the forest. She took herself to the shelter of a nearby tree and waited, concentrating on breathing slowly. Kane's whereabouts never left her mind.
They gone.
Peering around the tree, Bridget saw shadows running through the forest away from the clearing.
Yeah, well, maybe they're pulling up stakes for now, but I got a feeling those people may be back.
Bridget stepped out from behind the tree and looked at the 2 dead men lying nearby.
Bridget, come quick! I found Kane! He's not breathing!
Plunging through the brush and swinging around the trees, Bridget homed in on the albino's voice.
Where are you, Domi? Keep talking so I can find you!
I'm over here, near the clearing. Don't know how, Miss Kane!
Grant crashed through the heavy underbrush, having an easier time of it because he was big enough and strong enough to push it all out of the way. Without a word, he gripped Bridget's upper arm and guided her through the forest. They crossed the bodies of two of the men Domi had executed with her knives. There, at the edge of the clearing, Kane lay unmoving. Bridget threw herself down on her knees beside Kane. She scanned him frantically, but saw only scratches and superficial wounds. As Domi had said, Kane wasn't breathing. His skin took on a bluish tint from him being cyanotic as she watched.
He was shot.
Where? I don't see a wound.
Grant dropped to the ground beside her, raking a knife from his boot. With his free hand, he pointed to a piece of flattened metal embedded in the Kevlar vest over Kane's heart.
He was shot here. Big gun. Vest kept the bullet from ripping into his heart or lungs and probably saved his life, but the hydrostatic shock stopped his heart. Must have hit him between beats. I've seen it happen before.
Bridget knew all about hydrostatic shock. After she started going into the field with Kane and Grant, she had read up on wounds and injuries that military men could suffer. Although the Kevlar vest had stopped the bullet, it hadn't stopped the kinetic energy the bullet had delivered. It was like getting hit with a blunt object. There would be no penetration, but the hydrostatic shock was considerable. At the very least, Kane would be bruised and hurting for days. Grant stripped the Kevlar vest from Kane, revealing the dark bruising already taking place across Kane's upper chest. Judging from the impact area and the bruised, purple and red flesh, the bullet had struck Kane squarely over the heart. Bridget knew from her reading that such injuries could be deadly. Professional boxers and men trained in martial arts could deliver the same kind of blow with a fist. If the blow hit at the right time, it could stop a man's heart. Her agile mind processed that information in the space of a drawn breath. A drawn breath she was only too aware that Kane didn't draw. How long had he been like that? She didn't know. She struggled to guess at how long it had been since he'd called her name to warn her. Had it been that long? Had it been too long? His eyelids flickered, twitching slightly.
He's not dead.
Bridget thumbed one of Kane's eyes open. The blue-gray iris stared back at her without seeing. The black pupil contracted and expanded rapidly, reminding Bridget of a crow taking wing for some reason. A crow was often regarded as the symbol of death, she thought, then pushed the nugget of information from her mind. With her memory, everything stuck, including useless details that cropped up at the oddest of times. Red filmed the white of Kane's eye, spreading from the tiny burst capillaries. Bridget was suddenly aware of how her hand stuck to the side of Kane's head. She pulled it away, gazing at the bright blood on her palm.
What is it?
Grant leaned in closer. Tilting Kane's head, Bridget relaxed a little. The blood came from a laceration at the back of Kane's skull, not from a bullet hole. She remembered how easily the 22 rounds had penetrated the heads of the two men she had shot. Those holes hadn't been large either.
Has he been shot?
Bridget ran her fingers over the wound. There was only swelling, no puncture.
No. He must have hit his head when he fell.
Her quick eyes spotted strands of Kane's dark hair threaded into the tree bark next to him, even as she cupped the back of his neck and tilted his chin up.
I need you to administer CPR, Grant, otherwise we're going to lose him.
Grant nodded and moved closer. His big face remained impassive, but Bridget suspected seeing Kane like this was taking its toll on him. She peered down Kane's throat, making sure there was no obstruction, then leaned down and put her mouth on his, breathing into his lungs twice. There was no response except the continued eye twitching.
Start the chest compressions.
Bridget glanced over to Domi and saw that the albino was already standing watch over them. Domi's fiery red eyes roved over the forest restlessly.
Give me 15 for every 2 breaths.
Grant nodded and placed his hands together, one over the other, took his measurement from the bottom of Kane's ribcage, then fell forward, using the weight of his shoulders to drive his hands against Kane's chest.
1, 2, 3.
Grant counted as steadily as a metronome, as if it weren't his friend lying on the ground in unfriendly territory, trapped somewhere between life and death. Bridget took another deep breath and leaned down to breathe into Kane again. When she drew back, she saw that his eyes were still twitching. It was REM, she realized suddenly, not some kind of reaction to a concussion. The rapid eye movement indicated that he was dreaming. But dreaming about what? Bridget wondered. How could he be lying there dreaming when he was dying? She leaned down and breathed into Kane again, watching his chest rise in response. She pulled back, watching as Grant drove the wind from Kane's lungs again. The carotid artery at the side of Kane's neck remained smooth, showing no signs of a pulse, but his eyes kept twitching.
Kane.
Brigid hoped he could hear her voice and find his way back to her.
Kane!
Kane heard his name being called and opened his eyes. He stared up into the wind and sunburned face of a young man looking down on him worriedly.
My friend, are you all right?
A young man stood over him, smiling uncertainly. Realizing that he was lying on the ground, Kane started to sit up. The young man placed an open palm against Kane's chest, restraining him gently.
Easy. If you get up too fast, you can pass out again.
Pass out? The observation didn't make sense to Kane. He'd been shot. Passing out had nothing to do with it. He took a deep breath reflexively, remembering the incredible pain that had slammed into his chest. If he hadn't had on the Kevlar vest, the slaver would have killed him. Then Kane grew aware of the sand under his back. It was sand, not the thick, muddy loam of the swampland. And the sand stuck to his back, his bare back. For the first time, he took stock of the young man watching over him. The young man was in his late teens or early 20s. His body was thin and bronze, but the lines of whipcord muscle showed through in his chest and arms, and in his thighs and calves as he squatted bare-legged at Kane's side. An abbreviated skull cap covered his head, leaving his ears poking out the sides. His eyes were so dark, they looked black. His face was sharp, featured like that of a hawk. A stained white cloth wound around his loins, and leather sandals twined around his calves. Scars marred the young man's smooth skin.
Where am I?
Kane's mouth felt as though it were filled with the powdery amber sand spread out around him. The young man frowned.
You don't remember?
No.
For one teetering moment, he grew afraid, remembering how things had been when he'd traveled to the other casements through the power of the Chintamani stone. But this didn't feel like those journeys.
These are the Pharaoh's lands.
Which Pharaoh?
Joseph.
The young man smiled curiously at Kane and shook his head.
Are you sure you're not playing a joke on me, Kanak?
It's no joke.
With the young man's help, Kane sat up and gazed around him. At least 100 other young men in similar garb toiled under the hot midday sun, all of them carrying blocks up onto the hill where a pyramid was being built. Overseers dressed in shirts and pants carried whips and stood in groups under small cloth tents.
What is my name?
The young man frowned a little more. Kane looked at him.
I don't know you.
Now isn't the time to be kidding around. I'm getting a little concerned about you. We've been working in this merciless sun a lot for the past few days. The Joseph's vizier is a damned harsh taskmaster.
Kane shook his head and felt mildly dizzy. He glanced down at his chest. Like the other man, he went shirtless and wore only a loincloth. His burnished skin was darker than he could ever remember it being. But where were Brigid, Grant, and Domi? When he jumped to the other casements, he'd found them there as well. Automatically, Kane checked around for his weapons.
What are you doing?
Looking for my weapons.
The young man held a finger to his lips and glanced quickly at the nearest overseers.
What are you doing talking like that?
Kane looked at the other man.
Slaves don't have weapons, Kanak. If the Pharaoh's men even guessed what we have, they'd kill us.
Slaves?
Kane's mind wobbled, and he remembered the slaves they'd saved in the clearing in what had been Texas. Maybe they'd saved them, he amended. The play hadn't turned over the last card when he'd checked out. He wondered if being shot had caused the hallucination he was now having. In the past, there had been visions of past lives. Usually in those, Brigid had been there as well. He gazed around, watching the heat shimmer over the endless sand dunes around the pyramid area.
Anamkara.
The term was an old one he'd learned in Ireland. It meant soul friend.
I'm truly beginning to believe there is something wrong with you, Kanak. If you don't remember about the weapons and that you're supposed to keep your mouth shut about them, then...
Kane turned to the young man, shutting him up with a steely gaze.
What's your name?
The young man touched a hand to his chest in obvious disbelief.
I am Bakari. Surely you remember me. We grew up together. Remember that time when I fell in the river and you...
A wave of nausea rolled over Kane. The incredible desert and its shimmering dunes faded from sight for a moment. He gasped and almost retched.
I need water.
Maybe that would clear his head.
Of course.
Bakari bent and helped pull Kane to his feet. Taking Kane's arm across his shoulders, the young man helped him stumble across to the nearest tents, where the overseers stood with their cruelly braided leather whips. The sight of the whip reminded Kane of the younger mother he'd seen whipped in the clearing near Grande River. His fists clenched as two overseers turned to face them.
What are you doing?
Kane didn't answer.
You can't challenge these men. They'll kill you for the slightest wrong look. They've already killed a number of men.
Somehow, Kane knew that was true. Stubbornly, knowing that living longer meant learning more, he lowered his eyes. There was no wind, only the dry, still heat that beat down from the cloudless sky and radiated up from the sand. The two men stood side by side, stepping out of the shade of the tent.
What do you want?
Water. My friend Kanak collapsed from heat exhaustion, can't you see?
The big man nodded into the tent.
Get some water. Not too much, or he'll be throwing up and getting even further dehydrated.
Yes, thank you. May Ra's blessings be forever on you and your get.
Bakari helped Kane stagger into the shade of the tent. Huge clay pots sat in the center of the tent. Kane leaned on one of them and peered down into the tepid water it contained. His own features were reflected back at him, and he was surprised by the way he looked. He was no more than a boy himself, perhaps not even as old as Bakari. Still, his eyes looked pale, though he knew the blue-gray color wouldn't be a normal occurrence in these surroundings.
We're in Egypt.
Bakari took a dipper from one of the clay urns and filled it.
Of course we're in Egypt. We've been in Egypt for years, ever since our village was robbed by Djoser's warriors and all the people enslaved.
He paused, handing the dipper to Kane.
Some days, even though I try to remain of good cheer, I think the dead ones were the lucky ones. At least they did not live to become slaves and die in this damned sun.
Bakari glanced skyward.
Ra, forgive me if I have offended.
Kane drank the tepid water, finding it almost scalding to the taste, and the smell atrocious. But at least it was wet. His stomach rumbled threateningly, but held. One of the guards moved threateningly close to them.
Come on out of there. There's a lot of work to be done. If you don't hurry, I'll send you back out there with a bleeding back.
Swallowing his anger, Kane strode back out of the tent. Bakari walked at his side, thanking the guards profusely and ducking his head in subservience.
I swear, Kanak, one of these days that stiff-necked pride of yours is going to be the death of us.
Kane stared at the four-tiered pyramid sitting high on a gently rounded mountain of sand. He filed Djoser's name away for future reference, in case this didn't turn out to be just a dream of some kind, and in case he didn't wake up dead in the next couple of minutes.
This is Djoser's pyramid?
Yes. Didn't the water help you?
Not by memory.
Kane joined a group of workmen at the bottom of the pyramid and seized a stone from the pile there. He fell into line with the men trudging up the pyramid's side, shifting the hot rock so he carried it over his right shoulder. He'd been shot in the chest with a heavy caliber weapon. He remembered that. And even with the vest, there should have been some damage. He should have felt something, but he didn't. Bakari picked up a stone and followed Kane. His sandals slapped against the stone.
Can you believe the Pharaoh is building this structure of stone? Stone!
He walked wearily up the incline.
What is the purpose of building something of stone?
At the top of the first mastaba, Kane halted and looked back. The view afforded him from that position looked out over a slow-moving river in the distance, as well as a tent city encamped on the banks of that river. Small boats trawled the waters, and men aboard them brought up nets of fish.
You build a structure of stone. You want to keep something locked away from other people.
Well, since he means to bury himself here, I can understand that. Well, the way Djoser's been taking over villages here and taking over villages there, he's made a lot of enemies. Maybe they wouldn't be brave enough to stand up to all his soldiers, but I'll wager there would be more than a few that would be willing to piss on his grave. If I caught myself with a full bladder and no one looking, then you can bet I'd be tempted to piss on his grave.
Kane ignored the rest of Bakari's tirade and watched as slaves carried a litter up one of the gentle hills leading down to the gray-green river. Wispy material shrouded the litter from the sun. 8 male slaves dressed in matching loincloths trudged through the burning sand with their burden.
And probably write my whole name and the names of my family. You know I have the bladder of a camel.
Who's that man?
That's no man.
Kane watched as the litter neared the pyramid. Slaves dropped immediately and placed their foreheads on the sand, their hands flat out beside their eyes. The overseers dropped to the ground as well. One old man, stumbling under the weight of a stone, didn't prostrate quickly enough to suit the overseer standing next to him. The overseer swept his metal-encased whip handle across the old man's face, drawing blood and knocking the old man unconscious on the ground.
Get down!
Bukhari knelt at Kane's side, then reached up and grabbed his wrist. He pulled fiercely.
Get down now or die!
Giving in, Kane prostrated himself on the first level of the pyramid. But he still looked up and saw the figure shifting on the inside of the shrouded litter.
Who is that man, Bukhari?
May the gods protect us, Kanat, for surely the sun has addled your brains. As I told you, as you should already know, that litter carries no man. It belongs to the god Set.
With the whole world in stillness around him, the passenger pushed open the shrouds of the litter and stepped down onto a slave's back, then onto the sand. He was dressed in a hooded black robe that hid his face from view. Kane watched with increased curiosity as the man reached up and pulled his hood back. When he saw the man's features, Kane's breath locked in the back of his throat. Although he had never seen the creature alive, Kane knew who he was. There was no mistaking the narrow, elongated skull or the bony shape of a famine victim. The creature's long, skinny arms ended in hands that only had four fingers, possessing razor-sharp claws. There was no opposable thumb. He was bald, and brownish-gray skin covered him. A central ridge of bone ran from the top of his head to the bridge of his flattened nose. Double rows of serrated teeth showed through the lipless mouth. More hard-edged bone protruded over his eyes. His cheekbones were so sharp they threatened to cut through the wrinkled skin. With the light gleaming down on him, his skin held a hint of glistening scales. His name was Enlil. From what Kane had learned over the past 2 years, Enlil was the last of the Anunnaki, the alien race that had landed on Earth when humankind was in the early stages of development. Kane knew Enlil was dead, or at least in some form of suspended animation. He had seen the creature's body and Lord Strongbow's fortress, and Lakesh had only recently seen the corpse while a guest of the Imperator. Unable to help himself, Kane stared at the creature. What the hell was Enlil doing in ancient Egypt?
Whatever you do, don't talk to Set. You probably wouldn't get the chance anyway, but don't try.
Before Kane could say anything, the wind shifted over the mastaba and brought with it whirling sands. And on that wind, Kane heard Bridget calling to him. The world darkened around him as Set started up the mastaba.